Welcome back, Coast to Coast AM. Now we're heading into Monday morning. When we come back after this short break, Dr. Kenneth James is going to join us, and we're going to talk some Carl Jung. Carl Jung and UFOs. And before we get to that, I want everybody to go and check out the story. We have it up with a video over at Coast to Coast AM and the story that goes along with it about an amateur astronomer. His name is Ethan Chappell. And he just captured the incredible moment when something just slammed into Jupiter earlier this week. In the footage, the impact appears as a bright flash into the planet's upper atmosphere just south of the equator. Now, other astronomers have yet to confirm what the impact actually is, but according to Chappell, it looks awfully like a meteor crash. Do you remember? I'm going to go back. It must have been the mid-80s when they had a stream of meteors crashing in to Jupiter. We had a little bit of warning, right? And we were able to watch that. Incredible. Well, you can check out the video right now over at coasttocoastam.com. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. You can follow me on Twitter at jchurchradio. Any questions or comments, just post it right there. Twitter is always left of me. It's right here, live in the studio. The lights are down. It's Doc, and I'll be right back. Stay with us. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Now our guest is Dr. Kenneth James. Dr. James is a Jungian analyst in private practice in Chicago. He is the founder and director of the Soul Work Center, dedicated to facilitating the process of individualization according to Jung. Dr. James received a PhD in communicative studies and disorders from Northwestern University and a diploma in analytical psychology, which is the degree of a Jungian analyst. Now, from the C.G. Jung Institute of Chicago, Dr. James holds the rank of professor emeritus after a 33-year career as a university professor. He has served on the faculty at Roosevelt University, Northeastern Illinois University, and Northwestern University. I would like to welcome to Coast, Dr. Kenneth James. Good morning, Dr. James. How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning, Jimmy.
And, you know, what we're about to talk about tonight, which is Carl Jung and UFOs, this is something that most, even if you are into Carl Jung and study him, most probably don't know about this book, do they?
That probably is true. It isn't one of the most popularized of Jung's many, many interests. And the book that he published on it came very late in his life, just a few years before his death. So.
Yeah, he died in 1961. The book was published originally in 1958.
Right.
And during that period, when you think about the hysteria that was engrossing the country at that time when it came to the subject of UFOs, not only with sightings, but with the Air Force and movies and books and magazines, it was everywhere. Did he get wrapped up in that, or was it something more personal for him?
Well, I'm not sure if it was more personal, but certainly the fact that it was a collective phenomenon would have interested him, because Jung was dedicated to finding evidence for his understanding of the mind, of the psyche, anywhere he could. So this is why he studied alchemy. This is why he studied divination. And I believe that this was also what brought him to explore the UFO phenomenon.
How
for him, everything that involved the human community was an expression of all of the layers of the psyche.
Right. And how far ahead of the curve was he really? It seems when we have the subject of individual development, where so many on this planet today are doing just that for their own reasons, who may not have ever read anything about Carl Jung or his development of the individual. They may not know anything about that, but it seems more relevant today than it probably was when he was alive.
It's good to hear you say that. Jung called his notion of human development, individuation. And he chose that word very deliberately because he said, although we think of ourselves and call ourselves individuals, we actually are divided within ourselves. So we are individuals. And it was only through the process of living that we can grow to bring all of the parts of ourselves together to some sort of sense of wholeness. And that was what he called individuation, the movement away from being divided within ourselves. And I do think the human person longs for wholeness. That seems to be part of being human. And possibly at this time in human history, when we have access to so many resources that can show us how divided we are as a world, it would not be surprising to see people moving toward what Jung called individuation, whether they've ever read about him or not. He certainly didn't have a patent or a trademark on the process. And that process is simply one of the byproducts of being alive.
Now, I've read the book, and I'm not sure, and I certainly need your comment on this. I'm not sure if he had seen a UFO or not. He certainly implies in the book that he wanted some of that action, like he did with other things with the paranormal. Right. He was out pursuing this, right?
Yes. I think that he is on record, not in the Flying Saucer book, but elsewhere, saying that he had not himself had the experience. And for Jung, that was really unimportant because he wasn't questioning the validity of the experience that others reported. Quite the contrary. He was saying, we need to take what others are reporting and work with that. We don't get anywhere psychologically if we begin to impugn the witness, if we begin to question the truthfulness of what people are telling us, because that's a rabbit hole that has no bottom. Rather, take what's being told and take what's being told from a variety of sources. And all of the things that people were reporting had amazing congruences. And that was what interested him. So he approached these reports, as he did anything else that he encountered and studied, with the utmost respect for the reporters and for what was being reported. Because for him, everything was an expression of the reality of the psyche.
What about in the 1950s, we had a general sense of hysteria, right? It had elevated into a panic mode. Today, with the UFO subject, it seems like everybody's a lot more calm, cool, and collected about it, and are taking the news of these sightings and mass media in stride. In direct contrast, the way that things were dealt with in the 1950s, how would he look at popular culture today and the way that we are dealing with it?
Well, of course, the speculation is always risky, but I'll risk it. I think that in the 50s, since we were still very much a post-war nation, and there was even war going on at that time in Korea, I believe. I think that the collective consciousness, if you will, of the world, and certainly of our nation, but of the world, because these reports came from all over, was still very defensive and very concerned about attack. And as we've moved 60 some years from that time and have had a great deal revealed to us that was unavailable to us for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was availability of easily accessible media, I think some of that has died down. I think some of our understanding and appreciation of cultures and societies other than our own have increased. I think that this sort of dampens down the fear element and allows to emerge what is really more fundamental to the human community, and that is curiosity. What does this mean? What can we do to be a part of this new reality that's coming to our awareness? That really is what emerges when fear drops away. And I think that may be what we're seeing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then there's the other aspect of the hive mind, which he writes about a lot, and the approach of everybody must be seeing something, but yeah. Then it spreads across the culture where now it turns out that they're seeing the same thing, and the influence goes worldwide, doesn't it?
Well, right. And it's not so much a question of are they seeing the same things. I think we could deduce that they are. But there seems to be commonalities in the way they're expressing what is being experienced. And there's where Jung focuses.
Right. And when you have different cultures and societies on opposite sides of the planet that are not different languages, right? They're not communicating with each other.
Right, right.
We don't have the internet, but they are saying the same things and also communicating the same messages that they are receiving too as well. That's where it goes beyond coincidence, and he recognized that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, of course, Jung never, I think, really believed too much in mere coincidence. And he did view all of what is going on with UFOs, as with so many other phenomena that he studies, as examples of what he called synchronicity, meaningful coincidences, that when these coincidences occur, it's important to take a look at what is the meaning underlying them, what's really being expressed underneath the words, underneath the details. What are we really sharing with one another across culture?
Now, he also called the flying saucers a modern myth.
Yes.
What was the definition of myth that he was applying there?
I'm glad you brought that up, because in current usage, the word myth tends to be equated with lie. So you'll read the five myths about orange juice, or the five myths about cholesterol drugs or something. And what is really meant in those expressions is the five false beliefs about these phenomena. Because for Jung, the notion of myth is much more profound. A myth is a truth expressed symbolically that cannot be expressed in any other way, but that is necessary for the integrity of the culture or society that expresses it.
Give me an example of that.
Well, let's take an example of some of the myths that certainly I was raised with. One of them, and a lot of them are embarrassing now, but the idea that somehow, quote unquote, conquering the West was the manifest destiny of the United States. Okay, that's a myth. That's something that the culture possibly needed to sustain coherence and to move forward in whatever we needed to do to develop as a nation. To move to another realm that is probably more easily accessible as mythic, any religious tradition contains stories, origin stories, stories of how the community survives through time, stories of what the community can expect going forward in the future. All of these, from the psychological perspective, are myths. They are stories that particular communities hold to in order to provide coherence and direction. And when we say that they are myths, we're not in any way disputing the profound nature of these scriptures or myths for the people that hold them. What we're looking at, what we're saying is we're looking at them as a psychological reality. And we have collective myths. I think probably each individual, if they searched themselves, would find a personal myth that guided them. And in fact, it is the search for the personal myth that is the foundation of the method of therapy that Jung developed, called analytical psychology. So myth is a very, very important and well-defined concept, one of the few well-defined concepts in Jungian psychology, something that all Jungians would agree on.
One of the things that Carl talks about is witnessing something in person. We talked about it briefly. If you and I and Carl were out at night and saw something that we couldn't explain, something saucer-like, right? Not a plane, not a helicopter. The three of us see it. We all three have our interpretations. But would he think that he saw something from off planet, or would he look for another explanation?
Well, I can't speak, you know, really for him, but what each of us would come up with as our explanation of what we witnessed would reflect our own personal history, our own personal sort of tendencies. And if you or I were much more interested in astronomy and the universe and the possibility of life on other planets, we may concretize what we're seeing as a UFO, as a flying saucer. Jung may concretize it in another way. Someone else with a different background may concretize it. Someone else may see angels. Someone else may see who knows what. The important thing, though, is that there is something in the so-called outer world that is being witnessed, and that is being interpreted through what I've stored up in my so-called inner world. And when those two meet, there's where we have the significance of the phenomenon.
He wrote about a specific seance that he was at. You and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago. And he was at the seance. Witnesses around him all saw these orbs. I'm paraphrasing here, but but something happened in the room. Everybody saw except for Carl. And he was completely fascinated with that, in that he felt that this happened for everybody in the room.
Yes.
Everybody but him. He wanted to see it, though, didn't he?
He did. He studied, in fact, his doctoral dissertation was on the psychology, he titled The Psychology of So-Called Occult Phenomena. And it was the study of a spiritualist medium who happened to be his cousin, and some of the phenomena that he witnessed at seances that she held. Jung's mother was a spiritualist, so that played a part, possibly, in his interest. But there is a lot of reasons why, even with his deep desire to experience what others were experiencing, Jung may not have experienced it, and it may have been a quality of his mind at the time. Jung was very concerned about being empirical.
Let me jump in right there, Dr. James. We need to take a break. This is Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about Carl Jung, his book, Flying Saucers. And we're going to do this for the rest of the show. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Tonight, Dr. Kenneth James is with us. We're discussing Carl Jung and his book, Flying Saucers, and it was published in 1958. Of course, Carl Jung left this earth in 1961, but we are in exciting times today when it comes to disclosure and UFOs. And man, it would be great if he was around to see what was going on. I am your host, Jimmy Church. It is now officially Monday morning here in Los Angeles, and I'll be right back after this short break with our guest, Dr. Kenneth James. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I am your host, Jimmy Church. Tonight, our guest, Dr. Kenneth James. He's a Jungian analyst, and we are talking about the book. It's called Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth, Things Seen in the Sky, that was released back in 1958. Now, Dr. James, Was Carl concerned about his career in writing a book like this? Did it concern him?
I don't think that concern about his career was a primary motivating force in any of Jung's writing or really in any of his work. Fairly early on in his career, it became clear that what he was doing with his theories of the psyche, of the mind, was distinctively different than the trends of other schools of psychology. And he made peace with that early on when he broke with Freud in the early part of the 20th century. And so after that, he was primarily motivated by gathering evidence for the validity of his concept of the psyche, his understanding of the structure and dynamics of the psyche, and also his theory was always open to modification based on what he was able to gather from all of the very many disciplines that he studied. So his theory was not static. I think there's a publication, something that he wrote that said he really didn't have a system per se, but what he had was a way of encountering what's going on in the world, both outwardly and inwardly, and trying to understand that in terms of what it meant about revealing something to us about the human person. So the short answer is probably not. I don't think that that was a concern for him.
I'm going to paraphrase the way that he approached this. He said something to the effect of, I know what you guys are going to think, but about writing about this subject, but dang it, I'm going to do it anyway because it has to be said.
Right, right. I think that he said in the introduction to the Flying Saucer book that as long as people continue to wonder about this, and as long as we keep getting reports that are not 100% certain about what is being experienced, he believed that that was evidence that there was a very important psychological element in what was going on, that this was affecting people at a very deep level. And that was what provided him with the motivation to move forward in his investigation and ultimately to write his book.
How did he approach the abduction and visitation? Because it's one thing to witness something in the sky, right? And talk about that. But then there is direct contact, which was all over the place in the 1950s, probably more then than is happening right now.
Yeah. I think there, just like with everything else, I don't know that there would have been, in his mind, a special category for direct contact or abduction or anything like that. These were all different ways that the phenomenon that was being experienced was expressed. So all of that would be viewed en masse. He wouldn't give preferential interest to any particular expression of someone's experience.
The second half of his life, which was virtually dedicated to alchemy, there's that part of it. But to get into that state of mind, if you back up in his life, and certainly he would analyze himself the same way, that something happened. Did he have a supernatural experience that opened him up to these possibilities, parallel worlds and ET contact?
I think he had many what we would call supernatural experiences. For him, they were curious experiences. They were experiences that moved him forward to try to deeply understand. Several sort of elements in his early history I'll mention. One was a vision that he had early on. I think he was maybe 10 maybe not even. And his father was a minister of the Swiss Reformed Church. And Jung recounts that he was walking home from school, and he had been plagued for several days, if not weeks, with what he knew was going to be an unthinkable thought, a thought that he should not be having. And he would fight it and fight it and fight it. But one day, for whatever reason, he reports that he decided simply to allow it to come. And what the vision was, on the way home from school, he would pass the cathedral in his town. And when he allowed the vision to come, he said it was a vision of God sitting on a throne. And actually, it was a toilet. And God dropped a turd, to use Jung's word, that crashed into and destroyed the roof of the cathedral. So he took that very seriously as suggesting something about what was going on in the religious organizations of his time. So that was an early vision that he had. Following his break with Sigmund Freud in, as I said, the early part of the 20th century, he went into a period that Jungians refer to as the period of his creative illness, and what non-Jungians refer to as his psychotic period. During which time he drew pictures and wrote all of the documents that have been published most recently in the Red Book, which was held in secret by the Jung family for many, many decades. And they were finally encouraged to allow it to be published. And it's a treasure trove of what happened to Jung during that very, very difficult period of his life, but how he dealt with it. He documented it. He drew it. He diaried about it. This was Jung's way to move forward to these experiences. And he recounts other experiences in his autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Sprinkled throughout his writings are his own personal experiences, both his own and experiences he had with his patients. So Jung was writing from a theoretical perspective and an experiential perspective. And I would say especially when he wrote about topics that we would consider esoteric, occult, or fringe in our society.
Does that help us? Is that an advantage for us, knowing that he had his critics, but he wasn't concerned about that? He wasn't worried about outside influences, that his work, his research, not only to help others, but to help himself, and his outlook on everything was from an honest approach, and it wasn't influenced by anything, was it? So that's an advantage today, isn't it?
I believe so. I think that if Jung provides us with anything, he provides us with what I would consider to be a model of integrity with respect to moving forward and not allowing anything to be considered not worthy of study, not worthy of investigation. You know, I often joke that before I became a Jungian, all through graduate school, which I found very valuable, but I think we were trained to ignore data. By that I mean we were taught certain theoretical paradigms, certain frameworks to understand, in my case, the psyche and the ways the psyche symbolizes. And so if something was experienced that was considered not necessarily part of the theory, we didn't talk about it. It was sort of over here. That was not what we were studying. We're studying this. And basically what we were studying, and this was, you know, in the early to mid 70s, that was kind of the zeitgeist of the time. What we were studying was what everyone could agree upon as valid data. I think Jung, that concept of what is valid data would never have made any sense to him. From early on in his career, he dealt with very difficult cases. His early psychiatric work prior to meeting Freud and working in Freud's school of thought for a while, his early work was with what we would call psychotic patients, in people that were inpatiented in psychiatric hospital, the Berkowski Clinic. And so he saw the most, what we would consider bizarre or unusual manifestations of human personality. And he considered it his job not to judge, categorize, and restrict, but to understand what was going on. And so with that mindset, anything Jung would say is worthy of deep study so that we could understand what it means.
When I was... Yeah, when I was, I feel like I interrupted you, and I apologize for that.
No, that's okay. But I just keep talking.
when I was 21, I was going through some changes in my life, like we all do at that age, and I'm looking for answers. But I also thought that at the age of 21, like we all do, that I was hip, cool, and aware. And we all know what that means. I get a hold of some of his material, I start reading it, and the things that he was saying about himself were directly what I was going through 50 years after the fact. And I thought to myself, this guy is hip and cool. Today, would he be, and I'm not trying to in any way demean or be cavalier here, but today, would he be hip and cool? Could he hang today?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think it's disrespectful to call him hip or cool. What that suggests is that he's expressing something that has universal applicability.
Right.
And if that's our definition of hip and cool, I would say absolutely yes. And, you know, certain parts of Jung's theory, certain parts of his form of psychology is called analytical psychology. Certain aspects of analytical psychology are considered very popular in hip and cool sectors of our society today. Sometimes I think they're oversimplified because for Jung, everything is connected. So you can't just talk about archetypes without talking about the collective unconscious.
Right.
You can't talk about the collective unconscious without talking about what he's called the self. And you really can't talk about the self without talking about what he would consider fate or destiny. So there's freedom, there's destiny, there's luck, all of these, which are pretty heavy topics. And, you know, this is why I think it takes a lifetime to really understand any great thinker. This would be, in my case, Jung is obviously someone that I've been focusing on, but this would be true of any great, a person who has a great theory or an understanding of the human community or an aspect of it. To really, really understand it, you have to go deep. But there will be factors that will resonate right away with a person's experience. And that, I think, is the doorway in. What you were describing is very much like my experience when I first read Jung. I thought, oh, now I'm reading somebody who understands me.
Who gets it.
Right, right.
And that's what I find so fascinating when we talk about, especially today, Dr. James, everything is connected. And people understand that now more than ever before. When he was referencing that everything was connected, we're talking about 60 years ago.
Right.
And it's not that easy 60 years ago to have people understand these concepts. Today, people recognize that everything is connected without any reference to Jung. And that's what I find fascinating. He was that far ahead of the curve.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that the fact that now people accept that without any reference to Jung or any particular person, he would find very gratifying. Because he was much more interested in providing humanity as a whole with different ways of understanding itself than he was with promulgating a particular theory. In fact, he is quoted as saying at one of the roundtables he would hold in his home in Switzerland, "I'm really glad that I'm Jung and not a Jungian," because he was very suspicious of schools of thought that develop around individuals, because he was deeply aware that a so-called individual changes radically throughout the lifespan. And so to say I'm a Jungian from his perspective would be disrespectful both of him and of the person who makes that claim. So the fact that now in popular culture, a lot of his ideas, especially the idea of everything being connected, the ecological perspective, is just common understanding. I mean, you have to be completely unaware not to understand that that is a truth. I think you'd find that very gratifying and wouldn't care.
Yeah, he understood the Jungian concept then and didn't want to be that guy. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Not he didn't want to be the Jungian. He didn't want to be Jung that the Jungians were, right? That's fascinating.
Absolutely. Well, he had written in one of his collected works, Volume 7, two essays in analytical psychology, which was a work that he revised throughout his life, which was pretty characteristic of his writing. There's a chapter in that book called The Mana Personality, M-A-N-A, and he took the concept of mana from, I believe it's the Polynesian culture, and it refers to a supernatural power that is attributed to a particular individual who then becomes like an idol or a king. And he was very wary because he said whenever an individual is viewed as being more than human, that both traps that individual and it traps all of the people who are holding that individual up as an ideal or an idol. And he said that stopped psychological growth and it stopped a dynamic relationship to the psyche. So I think he was very wary of the creation of idols, the creation of sort of leaders.
Well, let me jump in right there. We'll pick up when we come back after this short break. This is Coast to Coast AM. Our guest tonight, Dr. Kenneth James. We'll be right back.